LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Listen without limits. Unchain your brain. Change your thinking. Change your life. LegalizeFreedom.com.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host Greg Moffat and my guest today is Anthony Peake, who joins us to discuss the life and work of Philip K. Dick. Philip K. Dick was one of the most imaginative and original science fiction writers of his era, and since his death in 1982, his novels have continued to be discovered by each new generation of sci-fi fans. His stories have been adapted for the screen many times, including Total Recall, Minority Report, A Scanner Darkly, The Man in the High Castle, and most famously, Blade Runner. PKD, as he became known, was a periodic drug user with a colourful and sometimes chaotic personal life, a life which increasingly resembled those of some of the characters he himself created. Recurring themes in his work include the nature of reality, of time, of perception, and of identity, alternate realities, artificial intelligence, dystopian futures, authoritarian governments, drug use, and altered states of consciousness. Hello and welcome, Anthony, and thank you so much for joining us once again on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Hello, Bree. Great to talk to you again, Greg. We always have fascinating discussions.
Yeah, it's been quite a while since you were on. I know you've been here a long time. Guest on the show, and I think the last time we spoke, I might have to go through the archives to check, this is when we're having so many technical gremlins attempting to have an interview that I actually visited you at home to do the interview.
Absolutely, the Archons really don't like us, do they?
No, they don't. They've really got an in for you, haven't they? You know, so, but they do say, you know, when you get flack when you're over the target.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I do sometimes wonder. I mean, of course, I mean, it's suggestive of paranoia, but the amount of times that things go wrong when I go live. I mean, I've given up doing my live podcasts myself because I couldn't guarantee the system, even though I have, you know, a super expensive Wi-Fi in here, the best you can get. It's actually wired in. There should be no problem with it. And usually I'd go live and it would all go down. And then suddenly it'd be a writer's rain as soon as I'd finished. It was just extraordinary. But
yeah. Yeah, no, I can vouch for that. I mean, I've experienced that second hand, you know, when first hand actually with you. So strangeness prevails, high strangeness.
Absolutely.
Now today, Anthony, we're doing something which just popped into my brain a bit randomly, and I can't even remember what exactly why now, but there must have been some reference. Yes, it is. You can tell listeners about this. You recently online, you referenced your 2013 book, A Life of Philip K. Dick, The Man Who Remembered the Future. And I thought to myself, yeah, I read that at the time. Now, why didn't we do a show based around that? We're going to do that today. But you're going to be speaking about that at some point. Is that correct?
No, I spoke about Philip K. Dick, funnily enough, in Southern California last summer.
Right, sorry.
Where I did a series of talks for the world's biggest UFO conference called Contact in the Desert, which again, funnily enough, I'll be speaking again this year at as well.
Yeah, that's where I got it wrong, because you're going to be going back, yeah.
Yeah, and I was particularly interested in doing this because, you know, I was quite close by to where Philip K. Dick spent the final years of his life as well. So it was intriguing. There were a number of people who were involved in the event who actually knew him as well. So it was really wonderful to have the opportunity to talk about that. But yes, it's quite strange that we missed the opportunity to talk about the great Philip K. Dick, purely and simply because there's so much about his work that references the kind of stuff we're interested in, which is really, really intriguing.
Yeah, now, I've mentioned this in my recorded introduction, but for listeners who maybe don't immediately know the name Philip K. Dick, most people have encountered his work, if not through his novels, then through the film adaptations of his work, such as Blade Runner, most famously Total Recall, Minority Report, Scanner Darkly, The Man in the High Castle, and there's quite a few others as well, lesser known. But so that's really, and most of these made after his passing. So really, in his lifetime, he never really got to see his work reach that mass audience. But as a voracious reader of sci-fi, particularly in my teens, strangely, when I look back, I read almost none of his books, and I don't know why. In fact, the only one I can remember reading back then was The Penultimate Truth, which is a story about a civilization living underground, apparently because there's an atomic war raging on the surface of the Earth. But is there really? So I'll leave that with listeners if they want to pick the book up. But when did you first encounter his work?
Well, funnily enough, I'm very similar to yourself on this, that I used to really enjoy science fiction, but I really didn't get into Philip K. Dick's work until probably as I was in my early 30s. The reason being, I think, that I always found I'd made attempts to read his novels in the past, but I found them quite curious, the way he plays around with people's names and everything else as well. And maybe I wasn't mature enough to understand the subtlety of his writing. And it was only when I started writing myself professionally that I started to realize the number of parallels between Philip K. Dick's worldview and my own. And that's why I decided to, in fact, funnily enough, I referenced Philip K. Dick first in one of the chapters of my second book, A Daemon, A Guide to Your Extraordinary Secret Self, because I was interested in Phil's preoccupation with precogs, people who had an ability to see the future. And of course, that features very, very strongly in the movie Minority Report. And Phil, a lot of Phil's stories involve this concept of precognition. And I was interested to know more about him. And he was also fascinated by something else, human bicamerality, the idea that we are, in fact, not a unitary being, but we are two foci of consciousness, and In a Scanner Darkly is the classic of that. So his work really intrigued me. And the more I read about him, the more he intrigued me. And it was interesting that of all my books, the only book that a publisher has approached me to write was the book on Philip K. Dick. Usually, what I'll do is I'll pitch to the publisher, and the publisher will decide whether they want to buy the rights from me for or not, and then market it for me. But this particular book, they were intrigued because of my touching upon Philip K. Dick in The Daemon, and they said, "Would you like to write a book on Philip K. Dick? There hasn't been one for many, many years, and we know that you could take a very interesting approach to it," which is how the book came about. And I spent 18 months researching, reading all of Philip K. Dick's letters, interviewing a number of people that knew him, including two of his ex-wives, lots of his friends. And it was an extraordinary experience because you end up, when you write a biography like that, you almost start to think like the person. I felt at one stage I was really freaking out. But just very quickly, just to explain what stimulated this interest in Philip K. Dick, because it's a very curious story. I was invited to speak at Bolton Library many years ago after I'd written The Daemon. And Bolton Library, I don't know if you know it, but it is a wonderful old library in a place called Le Mont Crescent, which is built in about the 1860s, 1870s. And the library itself has the most wonderful lecture theatre, which is literally a lecture theatre, like a university lecture theatre, where people banked around you. And I was giving the talk on Phil on my book, The Daemon, and I had a slide which came up about Philip K. Dick, and there was an audible gasp in a group of people in the far right-hand side of the audience as I was looking towards the audience. And they started nattering to each other, which I thought was incredibly ill-mannered. And I thought, what's up with them? And then when I finished the talk, they came down to talk to me. And there was a group of about five or six of them. And the main guy in the group, Mick, started chatting to me. He said, "Do you know, it's so weird how we've ended up here." He said, "Because literally, I was taking back to the library 2 days ago a copy of this book." And he picked out the Philip K. Dick book. And it was one of the books I'd featured, literally the edition I'd featured in my talk on the PowerPoint demonstration. And he said, so we thought, this is really weird. This guy looks interesting. We need to come along. And he said, when you started talking, there were so many things you were talking about that were resonating with our own lives. And then he looked at me and he said, do you know that Philip K. Dick predicted you? And I said, no. And he said, yes. He said, have you read his book? Oh God, the title's just slipped my mind. Counterclock World, from the early 1970s. And I said, no, I hadn't. And he said, well, in that book, there is a character who has a way of reversing time and is also involved in research into life after death. And of course, as you know, my main areas of research is near-death experiences. And Mick then looked at me and he said, so Philip K. Dick had the opportunity of calling this character any name ever because he made up names, as we just discussed before. And he said, so of all the names in the world and all the names he could have come up with, what did he call this character? And I said, well, I haven't read the book, so I have no idea. And he said, he called him Anarch Peak. And I looked at him with absolute astonishment. And he said, so he had the first two letters of your first name and your surname without the E on the end. Chances of that? What are the chances of having a character doing that? And that really enthralled me and really fascinated me. And when I started to research on the life of Philip K. Dick, I discovered that in 1973, in February of March 1973, he had something he called his theophany, which was his feeling that God or a presence was coming into his life, something he called Valis, which is vast active living intelligent system. It's an anagram. And in this, he had at one stage what he called his Kandinsky dreams. And these were dreams where they were hypnagogic imagery or hypnopompic imagery, you know, that kind of imagery you get just before you go to bed or just before you wake up, where your dreams seem to impose yourself into your everyday waking reality and you see images. And he saw a series of images of paintings, which he was convinced were being beamed to him from the Hermitage in St. Petersburg, the great art gallery in St. Petersburg. And he came to the conclusion that these were being beamed to him by the Russians. But then he then saw a sequence of book covers, and he said he saw a series of book covers flashing back really quickly. Now, I then thought to myself, this could be strange. And when I wrote my book on Philip K. Dick, the book we're talking about today, I looked at the cover after my publisher had decided on the cover. And I looked at it, and if you check out the cover, it's very Kandinsky-like, you know, the way the imagery works in the book, showing a picture of Philip K. Dick and a kind of a shattered glass face. But the colours are very garish and very like Kandinsky-type colours. And I thought to myself, just imagine if when he was seeing all those books flashing past, my book flashed past, and he subliminally recorded seeing the book cover. And he could catch the first two letters of the author's name and the author's surname. Now, whether that is true or not, or whether you can even begin to believe that, but I just found that curious and strange.
Well, it is fascinating. It might sound fanciful to people, but when you certainly rereading your book, which I did before this interview, I was just reminded of like the extraordinary life that he lived, and he was in many ways he was his own stories, if you see what I mean. So nothing, I would put nothing out of bounds, I would say, and on that front. So what you're speculating about, I couldn't rule it out. I really couldn't. And when people, if people don't already know, when they learn about his life and his work, they'll probably feel the same about it. I mean, well, his central question, I think, really in his work is like, you know, what is reality? Which is a, you know, the biggest question that there is really, ultimately. And there's, you've already mentioned the overlap with your thesis in two ways. First of all, his time theories and, you know, and your work on time. It was back in April 2012 when we first spoke about your book, The Labyrinth of Time. still one of my favorites of yours. But also the bicameral mind idea, or a split personality, however you want to look at it, the Damon Eidolon thesis, that very much features in his work in different forms, a version of that kind of idea. For me, again, rereading your book, I was reminded, I mean, I knew this all along from encountering his work, I'd say mainly in the movies, but how much of a precog he was himself in so many ways. And when I look at where we are in the first quarter of the 21st century, his work and his writing, his ideas about dystopian future, control and surveillance grid in society, artificial intelligence, mechanical replacements for everything, including people, transhumanism, the rise of Asia, which you saw in Blade Runner. The only thing perhaps he saw as Japan turns out it's China, but there it was. And also in Blade Runner, the future, gleaming technological future, which so many people were speculating about in fiction and in fact during the 21st century, it's actually turned out to be a lot grubbier. And you see that world in Blade Runner, don't you? Technology, yes, but it's dirty, So, and all of these areas, I was reminded, by rereading your book, just how much he really did remember the future.
Yeah, I find it extraordinary. I mean, obviously, a lot of the symbolism that people associate with Philip K. Dick's vision of the future was very much, as much as anything else, Ridley Scott's imagery in the movie Blade Runner, and the idea of this kind of very curiously dystopian future where people living on the streets and it's permanently raining, and there were those wonderful umbrellas that illuminate the poles of the umbrellas that were illuminating. And funnily enough, because of the my writing on this, I had the opportunity. I did a TV documentary for French and German television around about 8 or 9 years ago, recorded a series of interviews in Paris. And my fellow interviewers were people like Rutger Hauer, for example, and it was fascinating getting his angle on the whole Blade Runner thing, because of course that very famous speech, and I've seen all these wonderful things, and I've seen over the shoulder of Orion and everything else as well, the death speech of Blatty, the android. And he apparently just wrote that the night before and ad-libbed it during the film. But I'm also now fairly regularly in contact with the actress that took off the android, Rachel, as well. So there's a lot of linkages I've made there. But the thing is with Phil, he did seem to recognize the future both in terms of the technology and how the technology was going to expand. And for instance, over recent years, with recent months, with Trump's regime in America now, I'm reminded of Phil's preoccupation with dictatorship in America. And a number of his later novels, particularly the ones when he was living in Fullerton, were very much describing an American dictator. And I can't remember the character's name now, but it occurs in a number of his novels. So clearly, he was very prescient when it came to that. As you say, the rise of the East also he was preoccupied with, and The Man in the High Castle as a novel is, of course, an alternate history novel where America is divided between two states, and of course the German sphere of influence and the Japanese sphere of influence because the Axis won the Second World War. And he has the idea of parallel times that are running together. But there is the other aspect of Phil, which also intrigues me even more, is his literal ability to see the future. And there are numerous accounts. Now, we all have to take into account that Phil was a novelist. Phil had an incredible imagination, and he did tend to embroider his own life. And I've discovered that by reading all of his letters. And you can tell that some things he exaggerates and embroiders in one way or another. But there are certain elements I've discovered in his life that really are completely and utterly inexplicable, whereby he knew what was going to happen in the future. And not only this, but his past self would use information that he was going to acquire in his own future to elaborate his plot. And I'll give an example of this. In one of his most famous novels, A Scanner Darkly, there is it A Scanner Darkly? I'm trying to remember now in terms of the, because Split Brain, Scanner Darkly was very much interested in, cry my tears, the policeman said, that's the one. And in this novel, there's numerous things take place. I mean, one of them, it involves him meeting up with a young woman called Kathy. You know, Flow My Tears came out about 1970, and he wrote it in 1970. And in December of 1970, he meets the character Kathy that's in the novel. And in the novel, he describes how Kathy is a drug dealer and she's having a relationship with an undercover narcotics officer. And it's a central part of the plot. And then he meets this girl, Kathy, and he's going into a restaurant, I think, with her one day. And she says, I can't go in there. And Phil turns around to her and says, why not? She said, well, the guy over there is a narcotics police guy that I'm having a secret affair with, and I'm feeding him information. And as Phil said, this was exactly what he'd written in his book. But he'd written the book a year before. And this then, you then look back into some of the other events, and one of them is just extraordinary. And in the same novel, Phil has a character who's very depressed about the death of his sister. And this guy, one night, goes out to an all-night gas station, I guess, to get gas or something. And when he goes into the gas station, he encounters a black guy who is desperately in trouble and needs financial help to buy some petrol because his car's run out of petrol. And the character gives the black guy some money and says, yeah, I'll help you out and everything else. And the black guy says, I'll pay you back at some time in the future. Phil writes this, and then 7 years later, he gets up one evening, he can't sleep, and he decides to go out and buy a newspaper. So he goes round to his local petrol station, and he sees a guy looking very agitated, and the guy comes over and says, can I borrow some money? Because I'm out of petrol. And it's at that moment Phil goes, my God, this is my novel. And the whole situation that he'd written in his novel panned out in front of his eyes under those circumstances. And of course, at that stage, Phil was also preoccupied with linkages between Phil believed that the time had stopped in 1870 with the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem, and that time had stopped from then, and everything was an overlay since that time. And he became particularly preoccupied with the biblical Book of Acts. And in Book of Acts, there is a character called Philip, who encounters a Nubian guy, a black guy, in the Bible. And Phil again was saying, this is links with the Bible, it's links with time, and everything is sort of playing around with itself in some way. And then I did some research, and I discovered many, many occasions where future events had fed back to his novels. And of course, you'll know from my book, The Daemon, A Guide to Your Extraordinary Secret Self, this is one of the themes I use in that. You know, where I cite many novel, and I argue that novelists, many of them, when they write their plot lines, they're writing about events they are about to encounter in the future. You know, Kipling is a classic example. Houseman was another one. There's a number of writers who've done this.
Well, yeah, as you've been pointing out, and I think it's a quote from your book that Philip K. Dick's life was, quote, a fantasy as rich as many of his stories. And there is a great overlap, isn't there? Like a Venn diagram, or perhaps more accurately, a blurring of his fiction and his own life. And of course, he was a drug user, various types of substances throughout his life. And suffered from paranoia, and so much of this fed into his stories, as you say. But where did those ideas come from? You know, was he somehow, as you say, pre-recognizing these events and incorporating into his fiction, or was he somehow writing? He would write his fiction, and that then panned out into events. But it's always occurred to me, as someone who absolutely cannot see the future and tends not to have precog type events in my life, that what a burden it must have been for him in many ways. That's how I would see it anyway. Reading your book again, I felt like there must have been such a weight, a psychological weight on this man.
Well, particularly because, of course, the final, literally, the final incident that took place, that Phil actually predicted his own death. And this is singularly the most extraordinary of all my writing and of all the things I've researched over the years. This, to me, is probably the most extraordinary thing ever. And the background was that I saw an advert, or was it a Facebook posting or something? And somebody was selling the original letters, some of the original letters that Philip K. Dick had written in the early 1970s. And she had posted an image of one of the letters, together with Phil's sort of handwritten details and the like. He used to type his letters, but it was handwritten. So I was able to research this in greater detail because it's very, very strange. And what happened was he started writing to a lady called Claudia Krentz, or Claudia Krentz Bush, who was an Alaskan lady who was living in Boise, Idaho, I think. And Phil started writing to her, and they swapped letters on a regular basis. They never actually met, I don't think, which is rather sad, but they obviously became very, very friendly. And some of Phil's letters are really quite interesting. But there's one he writes where he types the words, and I've written them down for you here because I usually paraphrase them. But he turns around and he says, "I was up at 5 a.m. on this last night." And what he was doing, he said he was trying to effectively evoke his daemon, the idea I have that there's a daemon which follows us through our lives. And I believe that Phil's communication channels with his daemon were quite open. And the daemon was manifesting. He called the daemon, as I say, Valis and various other things, and Ubik and various books. But the entity, he actually says in the letter that he bade the entity show itself. And then he has a series of fascinating hypnagogic or hypnopompic images, and he sees undersea cities and various other things. And then he turns around and he says, "And then one stark image," and I'll quote him. He says, "Inert but not still, a man lay dead on his face in a living room between the coffee table and the couch." And then he writes in handwritten form on the side. He says, "Claudia, I think I'm becoming precognitive." Now, this is a very curious thing, isn't it? The idea of this imagery he sees, and he believes he's being precognitive. But the ending of the story is terrifying because Phil and his wife, last wife, Tessa, split up, and Phil was living on his own in early 1982, almost to the anniversary coming up now, funnily enough. And he was living on his own, and his Tim Powers was a good friend of his, the science fiction writer who wrote the Anubis Gate. And I discussed this with Tim. We swapped emails on this as well to confirm how the circumstances had arisen. And Phil and Tim and a group of friends were regularly had regularly on, I think it was a Tuesday evening, used to meet for a book club. And one Tuesday in February 1982, Phil didn't turn up. So they were quite worried about it. So they went round to his house, and one of the ladies, they phoned one of his neighbors, and she broke into the house or broke the door down. And when they arrived at the house, doors were open, and the medics were there. The crash people had turned up. And Phil was being wheeled out. But the thing is, they spoke to the medics, and the medic said that when they broke the door down and got in, Phil was lying on his face in the living room between the coffee table and the couch. He saw his own death. He saw his own death circumstances many years before. In 1974, the letter to Gloria was written on the 9th of May, 1974, and Phil was found dying of a stroke on the 18th of February, 1982. Now, the fact, not only the fact that he described the circumstances of his own death, but also that he recognized it was a precognition from the letter, I think is one of the most uncanny evidence of human precognition I have ever seen, because the circumstances were quite unique. Now, I was very intrigued by this because I thought, how, if it was his daemon sending him a message, how was his daemon aware if Phil was completely unconscious? Because if you look at the imagery, and in fact, when I did the show, when I did the documentary, the French TV documentary for ARTE, they simulated this in image. Because with the exception of a comment that Tim Powers makes in the introduction to one of the collected anthologies of Phil's letters, I'm the only writer that's written about this. And they did a mock-up of showing Phil lying on his stomach. Now, the imagery would suggest that whatever Phil was viewing it, he was viewing it from a state of an out-of-body experience, wasn't he? Because he said he was looking down, seeing a man lying on his stomach in a room, which suggests that rather like with near-death experiences, he was in an out-of-body state. But the out-of-body state clearly was remembered by the daemon, and the daemon backfed to Phil the earlier incarnation, the imagery of his own death, presumably to help him try and avoid it in one way or another. Because the interesting thing is, I spoke to Tessa about this, his ex-wife, his last wife, and she assured me, because people say, if you read the reports, they say that Phil never regained consciousness, and he died on the 2nd of March. Tessa confirmed to me that no, he was conscious. And she visited in a hospital and his eyes were flickering and he was trying to talk to her before they, you know, and afterwards they switched off the machines because he clearly was dead, or the body was dead. But it means to me that some part of him was aware, and that's what sent the message back into the past. Now, again, if you start reading a lot of Phil's writings, particularly his exegesis, because Phil was a polymath. He was self-taught. He was an autodidact, but he was incredibly intelligent, incredibly well-read. And if you read his exegesis, which was published around about 12 or 13 years ago, with all these notes and everything else as well, you realize that these things have been happening all through his life. And indeed, there was an interview he made, I think somewhere probably in the early 1970s. No, it wasn't. I think it was probably later than that. But anyway, he was interviewed and he described how on one occasion him and Tessa were in bed. And Tessa confirmed this to me. And they could see a shadowy figure at the end of their bed looking down on them. And they both got quite disturbed about this. But Phil said the next day to her, "That was me from the future looking at us." And then he explained to Tessa that he had, when he was a child, when he was 5 or 6 years of age, he used to see a man standing at the end of his bed looking at him. And then many years later, he started having a series of dreams where he was back in his old bedroom looking at his younger self lying in bed. Now, this again is fascinating. And was Phil embroidered in this in some way? Well, if he was, he never mentioned it in any of his books. But there is a friend of mine called Myron Dial who lives in California. And Myron has had the same experiences whereby he's seen himself. He said, for instance, he remembers having a dream when he was a child of seeing an elderly man in an art studio with paintings around him. And he sees him from behind the back of his head in the dream. And he told me it was a reoccurring dream he had. And then one day he becomes an artist And one day he's in his studio and he has this prickling feeling in the back of his neck and realizes somebody's watching him from behind. And he turned around and he realized, he knew it was his earlier self from the past, dreaming the imagery of that room. Because when he was a child, he had no idea he would become an artist. This is the power of time. And this is what Phil argued. He had the idea that time itself, there were two sorts of time. There's what he calls vertical time, which is basically linear time. But there's another time that he discusses in the exegesis, which he calls orthogonal time, which runs at right angles to this time and all times. So, in fact, time is not what we think it is. We travel through time, but time is always there. And again, as you know, in my book, The Labyrinth and Time, I discuss Minkowski's block time. Minkowski, who was Einstein's teacher. And Phil references Minkowski as well. So the idea is that time is layered. There's layers of time, and we can go backwards and forwards, as indeed the central character in the movie Interstellar does when he sees his daughter's life in the Tesseract sequence in the movie.
Exactly. Well, you've arrived at a point where I was actually going to pick up the conversation. So that's perfect. And it's really that at the core of this in Philip K. Dick's life, but obviously in his fiction, was, the time theories that he had. And basically, that time is not what we think it is. Linear time is an illusion. I'm going to refer listeners to my last podcast, which was with Steve Taylor,
Oh,
called
great, Steve. Great
"Yeah,
writer.
Time to Admit That Time Is an Illusion." I think listeners should check that out because it's just about the nature of time. Whereas, we're bouncing back and forth on a few different subjects here, but that's the nub of it. In all of this, is that the past, the present, and the future, as we think of them, linear time doesn't work like that. It is literally, and I know it's a cliche, but it is a human mental construct in order to make sense of what appears to be happening. Literally, like here we are talking at 11:45 a.m. and something you did something before we spoke, and you're going to do something after we speak, and that appears to be how things are working. But the past is not gone. Past events are not gone. They're still here, as it were, and the future also is here, but there, we haven't selected those possibilities, shall we say, yet, as it were. So everything that can possibly happen already exists. It's very counterintuitive. It's definitely a mind bender, but that's what's at the root of Philip K. Dick's work in many ways. And of course, you spent so much of your writing career, talking about the nature of time.
That concludes part one of our interview. Part two will be available soon in the subscribers area at legalizefreedom.com.
Legalizefreedom.com.